I'm John Schumann with Medical Matters, the show about healthcare and the human condition. Coming up, author Sam Quinones talks about America's opiate addiction and how cheap heroin flooding the U.S. market contributes to the problem. But first, as he is each week, Gary Schweitzer of the website healthnewsreview.org is on the line from his home office in St. Paul, Minnesota to discuss the week's health news. Hi, Gary.
Good to talk with you again, John.
Well, we're glad to have you as always. So you are now analyzing news releases, right? So, or you're reviewing news releases. Tell me about that.
Well, this is an attempt to improve the flow of information by going further upstream and looking at the news releases that might affect the news coverage that then becomes the information that all of us receive as news consumers. So I think it's really important. We shouldn't take for granted that people know the difference between news releases and news stories. So news releases are written by, generally, public relations professionals who are professional and take their job very seriously. But let's face it, their job is to make their client or their institution or their product look better. And news stories are supposed to be independently vetted by journalists who should not be really following the agenda of anyone, but coming into work every day and trying to serve the public interest and public needs.
So are you finding that, are your reviewers finding that, is this a growing trend that more news sources are just relying on news releases?
Yeah, and unfortunately, I think it's often a manifestation of the more difficult economic times in the news industry. So there are fewer people expected to do more with less, and so you have a newsroom and you have journalists who fall prey, as it were, to special interests often trying to sell their wares. Now, I don't want to be too harsh about that. There are some very good public relations people. But as I'm about to tell you, the report card in our early experience is not very good.
All right, let's go. The report card is sent home to the parents. What do we get?
Well, parents, your child needs to improve across many of our criteria. So we've only looked at about 60 news releases, and I say only in quotes because no one has ever done this before. I think it really surprised the healthcare news release industry to learn that somebody was now going to be looking over their shoulder and checking their work. So we've only been doing this since April. And, you know, we assign a star score, like a movie review or a book review, to stories, and you can get from 0 to 5. Well, more than half of those 60 news releases we've looked at get failing grades of less than 3 stars. And as with our news story reviews, the 3 weakest criteria, again, are: did the news release adequately discuss costs? No, 96% of the time they do not. Did they adequately quantify the potential benefits? No, 73% of the time they didn't. And did they adequately quantify the harms of this wonderful new idea? And no, 84% of the time they did not.
Do you think it's endemic? I mean, you sort of hinted at that, but are public relations professionals sort of taught not to look at potential negatives or, you know, put a scope or a limit on what a potential benefit might be? In other words, here's a potential scientific discovery. Woohoo, this is going to change medicine or science as we know it. Let's not look at any disadvantages.
It's hard, and I will avoid painting that industry with too broad a stroke, because as with so many things, as in medicine, it depends on who you are, what your professional ethic is, and where you work, and what your cultural ethic is. But I can tell you, we look at news releases from government agencies. So, National Institutes of Health, for example, academic medical centers all over the country, industry, drug and device manufacturers, professional medical societies, and then there are some from entrepreneurial docs as well. And we've found flaws, for the most part, as I've already said, across the board. You want to hear a couple of examples?
Please.
In some buckets of categories?
I was hoping you'd have some.
Yeah, so over-promotion, hyping of animal research, for example. So we had a Stony Brook University news release on sleeping on your side to prevent Alzheimer's disease.
Sorry, that just makes me laugh on the face of it.
And the graphic that they used was a human profiled graphic, but this was a study in rats. We had a news release from the well-known St. Jude Children's Research Hospital that was promoting new treatments that could, quote, thwart colon cancer, but it buried the fact that this was mouse research. So it mentioned it, but it put it way down low in the news release. And then we can follow up and see news coverage that mimics these same flaws. We just published this one, and your listeners could find this whenever they come to our website and look for it. So a news release from the Journal of the Annals of Thoracic Surgery, so chest surgery, and it said that a particular surgical approach in the elderly was safe. Now, I don't know how you define safe, but when we looked up the study that the news release was based on, more than 30% of the patients in the trial had major adverse events within 30 days, and 13% died as a result of complications. I think we really have to tap into our audience better. Is that what you would call safe?
Doesn't sound safe to me.
We had a Northwestern University news release on a new psoriasis drug. There was no mention of cost. I told you that's one of our big bugaboos. And it was a new drug, but a comparison drug that's going to be very similar is $50,000 a year. You know, we have to start this conversation somewhere, John. Harms, benefits, costs, even in news releases, maybe especially in news releases, because of how they feed news coverage. If we're not given a very complete picture of benefits and harms and cost, benefit, and value, if we don't give a more complete and accurate and balanced look at these issues.
So your reviewers, you said, have looked at 60 different news releases. Is that about half of the news releases in the world since April? I'm just kidding, of course, because there's probably, what, hundreds a day, thousands?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Of the ones that are submitted, we have one person who looks and submits these every day. And to be eligible, it has to be a news release about an intervention, a treatment, test, product, or procedure, and it's got to include a claim of how good it is. We probably only review less than 10% of what is eligible on any given day. It is impossible to keep up. But once again, there isn't anyone else even dipping their toe in the water on this issue. So I think this is really important. And I'll tell you, talk out of both sides of my mouth here, the reaction from some news release writers in healthcare was one of shock. And we, in fact, I don't mind telling you, have been denied embargoed access by Eureka Alert, which is a service of the American Association for the Advancement of the Sciences. Frankly, I think because they think that we're a threat, that their clients, the people who publish news releases, aren't going to like what we say about them. So they will not give us embargoed access, which means the same head start, jump start that other journalists get. On the other hand, we have slammed some people. Interestingly, two European examples come to mind. The BMJ used to be the journal called the British Medical Journal. We have consistently criticized them for how they failed to describe the limitations of observational studies. And we've engaged them now, I think, in a really healthy dialogue about improving their work. And then the European Society of Cardiology, we actually told them that we put them on our wall of shame for an inadequate news release. And they wrote back very graciously and said, you know, we get your messages and we follow what you're trying to tell us. We don't want to be on your wall of shame again. So I love that when we actually have a dialogue with people who are not thin-skinned and defensive about our attempts at constructive criticism.
Gary, teach us a little bit about the news business. So these news releases, you say they're cranked out by organizations, hospitals, academic centers, pharmaceutical companies, even the government. Did they get pitched at journalists? Do journalists just get a steady stream of them across their desk or their Twitter feeds nowadays? And how do the news organizations decide when to run with a story or not? Is it just a judgment about what the potential public impact might be?
Well, all of the above methods that you started to describe and more come into play in this machine of feeding information to the news media and then therefore to many of us directly as consumers. So still some in print, lots more by email, increasingly more by social media, by Twitter, by Facebook. There are medical journals that actually produce video news releases for television stations, so the printed word might not be enough for them. So the journals will actually produce what look like professional television stories, and all the TV station has to do is plug and play, put their own person's name and voice and even picture on it, and it looks like they covered the story when, in fact, they never even left the newsroom. It can be a really insidious influence on what is supposed to be independently vetted news.
Wow, that's really shocking. I mean, I guess I'm kind of at a more innocent view of things. So they're even outsourcing the video feed to pretend like they're doing the actual reporting.
And give you either your choice, a satellite feed with the downlink coordinates, or it can be delivered to you. I don't know if they still do it by videotape, but they can deliver it to you online and in a manner where you can download the video and use it yourself.
Gary Schweitzer is the founder and publisher of the website healthnewsreview.org. He's shining the light of truth and putting people on his billboard of shame. Gary, we'll talk to you again next week. Thanks so much.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
I'm John Schumann. For questions or comments about the show, you can email me directly at John, J-O-H-N, at glasshospital.com. That's John at glasshospital, one word, .com. Doctors have long been considered misers in treating pain. The pain management movement has helped bring treatment for chronic pain out of the shadows and into the spotlight of everyday medicine. As we've become more comfortable prescribing pain medication, there is a downside. People can become addicted to the medication, and sometimes their appetite can increase, resulting in looking for alternative sources like pills on the street or even illicit narcotics like heroin. Author Sam Quinone spent years tracing a new pathway for heroin trafficking into the United States from a tiny town in west central Mexico. He tells of the cartel's entrepreneurial and innovative approach to selling only tiny quantities of very potent heroin to escape harsher prison sentences. His book Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, has become a bestseller. Quinones is a journalist and investigative reporter who's previously written for the Los Angeles Times. Sam Quinones, welcome to Medical Matters. I want to start by asking you, basically the book, as I see it, you divide it into multiple chapters where you go back and forth between various towns in the United States and then, of course, Mexico, where we learn about a very new variety of the heroin trade. But I guess I want to start stateside and ask you, if you can, recount why opiates have become such a problem in the United States.
Well, I think it really dates back to a revolution in medicine that began in the mid to late 1980s, really gained steam and momentum during the 1990s, and is pretty much part of our daily life today. And that this revolution held that we were a country in pain. It was an epidemic of pain. We were not treating pain at all, and we needed to. And the way to treat that pain mostly was with opiate painkillers. These are painkillers that most of your listeners would know, Vicodin, Percocet, Lortab, and of course in the mid-1990s, 1996, OxyContin is released. These are opiate-based painkillers that are molecularly very similar to heroin, which is also a painkiller. It was this revolution that really transformed, I think, medicine and pain management today. It was achieved because pain specialists at the time convinced doctors all across America that these pills were virtually non-addictive. That was the kind of the quote, the buzzword, virtually non-addictive when used for pain. Obviously, doctors want to help their patients relieve pain. Their one great fear, of course, is that these pills are addictive. Well, doctors, these pain specialists at the time, really did a wonderful job of convincing doctors that this was almost never going to be the case if it was used to treat pain. And, of course, they were just way wrong. There's ample evidence, I think, now to show that lots of people using these pills exactly as directed have become, in fact, addicted. But the idea was that we need to use opiates more. These pain specialists grew up at a time when opiates were never used, almost never used. It was the pendulum was on the other side of the spectrum, really, where the only way you ever got opiate painkillers was if you were dying of cancer, and then only if you had maybe three doctor's signatures. It was people were allowed to experience horrific, indecent pain while these pills were available. And this was also viewed as a wrong by a lot of these pain specialists who kind of developed almost a religious crusade to change that. In this religious crusade, I think they recognize now, a lot of them, that evidence was kind of thrown out the window, and they just were bound and determined to get people to use more of these pills. Doctors use more of these pills when treating pain. That created widespread use. That revolution in pain management created widespread use of these pills for all manner of ailments, not just terminal cancer pain now, but extracted wisdom teeth, post-surgery, chronic pain, a variety of chronic pain, all of which has led to a huge increase, I call it a rising sea level, of pain pills all across the country.
So you mentioned the medical innovation, which in a sense was going from some of these well-known drugs, like you said, Vicodin or Percocet, which most people have heard of, but then OxyContin was something that was new innovative. So there's a medical innovation, and what was really new about that was it was long-acting. That is, it was supposed to not give people the high. But then there was really the social transformation going on at the same time. For example, the Joint Commission that accredits hospitals was making pain the fifth vital sign, which you write about in the book. What does that mean, the fifth vital sign?
They wanted doctors to test for pain. Of course, you can't test for pain. It's an objective measurement. So there's no way of actually testing for it. But they wanted doctors to always kind of be asking, how much pain are you in? Can you give us a scale of 1 to 10? This is very difficult to measure because, of course, it's a subjective thing. But it was part of this pain revolution, which is we should always listen to the patient, believe the patient in whatever he or she says with regard to pain, always be heavily, heavily focused on treating that pain, making sure that there is no pain. This was the revolution, and the Joint Commission's idea of a fifth vital sign was part of that. There were a whole bunch of other ways that this manifested itself, but it was the idea that we should not be in pain. We should be treating pain at every juncture.
So where did this idea come along that somehow these newer pain medicines weren't going to be addictive? We had evidence to know that, short-acting pain medicines, the Percocets or the Vicodins, people were afraid to prescribe them because, doctors were trained to believe that this stuff was habit-forming. But now there was some new marketing, well, really based on some science, although I think you point out in the book the science was not that rigorous, right? I mean, what were people basing this on?
No, there was no science. I don't believe there was any science in the way that most people would understand it, of rigorous studies, time trials, all these things that, it would last years, studies of these kinds. The folks who were very intent on changing this attitude, this kind of religious crusade around opiate painkillers, fastened on a few small papers and one, not even a paper, a letter to the editor, to the New England Journal of Medicine in 1980, that held that painkillers could be used without risking addiction. Now, this one letter was very important in all this, not because the author of the letter intended it to be. In fact, the author of the letter ran a database of hospital records, and then one day just kind of ran a question through the database, how many people treated with opiate painkillers in the database eventually developed addiction. This was in 1980, and he comes up with 11,000 patients, and of which 4 developed addiction. He writes a letter to the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, say, we did this, and these are the results, and this is just FYI, in case you're interested. Nothing rigorous, he meant nothing really by it, he told me. I interviewed him many years later. But it was fastened onto you by these pain specialists and pain crusaders who said, this is proof. Look, we've got this thing here. It says, this is a letter. It's in the New England Journal of Medicine. You didn't say that it was like 101 words. It was not a study of any kind. But it was this kind of science, I guess, or very thin science, that began to change it. People were looking for a way to use these pills. They were looking for almost dispensation to use these pills, I think. And these kinds of papers or letters, in this case, were used as a way of saying, yeah, go ahead, you can do it. Where we know now, 3,000 years of dealing with opiate painkillers, beside the point, we know now that these pills can be used, so go right ahead and do it. And I think that was part of what happened, that people just wanted so badly to use these pills because doctors were really increasingly being left without any tools. Increasingly, insurance companies were not paying for a more multidisciplinary, integral approach, holistic approach to pain management. There are a lot of services that other kind of a more multidisciplinary approach to pain management used that eventually insurance companies were not funding. And so eventually doctors were left with only one tool, and that was opiate painkillers. And by the late 1990s, that was pretty much the case.
You're listening to Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. Our guest today is Sam Quiñones, author of Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. And Sam, before the ID, you were telling me about this letter, basically a 101-word letter to the New England Journal of Medicine that essentially became cited as gospel in this right. sort of mythology or this perpetuation that somehow opiates weren't addictive and therefore yeah. we should be more liberal in our prescribing of them. What role did, there's a company called Purdue Pharma, they're the makers of OxyContin, and they, I guess, got into some hot water, but they have originally marketed this drug as a real breakthrough, as a revolution.
Right, and in fact, pain specialists viewed the innovation of OxyContin as a huge benefit to them because it was the one way that they actually, it was a tool now that they had to treat pain. You don't, as a pain patient, don't have to now take 6 or 8 or 10 pills a day, constantly thinking about when your next pill is going to take your next pill. You take 2 pills, and it's a painkiller into your system over a period of 12 hours each pill. They viewed it as this remarkable innovation, and the pill company, Purdue, of course, pointed to these guys and saying, look, these guys think it's a wonderful idea. These guys think this kind of time release thing is fantastic. And they then, also because there were very few regulations on how these things could be marketed, they marketed it, and it was the first time, I think, the DEA pointed out in the history of pharmaceuticals that an opiate had been marketed as if it were an over-the-counter medicine. They marketed it to doctors, but with hats and pens and phone pads and trips to Scottsdale, all of which saying, hey, OxyContin, this is okay, we can use it. It's 1% less, virtually non-addictive, less than 1% non-addictive. They sent dads of salespeople out into the field to talk to doctors, convince them of this. They had a CD that they came up with called Swing in the Right Direction with OxyContin. And it had a bunch of swing tunes, Woody Herman, Count Basie, Benny Goodman, that kind of thing. It was a new kind of advertising of a very addictive product. And for a long time, it was that advertising was very successful. Eventually, they got charged with a misdemeanor of false branding by a U.S. attorney in Virginia. But for about the first 6 years of OxyContin's life, it surpassed every sales goal that Purdue ever set for it. And so within 5 years, I think they were selling $1 billion worth of OxyContin every year. Here's why OxyContin is also important for the story. That's a very important thing to note. It used to be that addicts or drug abusers, would use, say, Vicodin or Percocet, and they would use a lot and they would abuse it, but they would never graduate to heroin because the doses were so small, usually it's 5 milligrams, 10 milligrams. They would, and they could basically make that by pretty easily. They could find it on the street, enough money to buy a few of these pills every day on the street. There was nothing really that would lead them eventually to heroin. A lot of people were really careful. Oh, I'm not about the heroin. I'm just doing these pills, this kind of thing. Then, 1996, along comes OxyContin. Unlike these pills, Percocet and Vicodin, they all could contain acetaminophen or Tylenol, something to prevent abuse. So if you use a lot of them, they're going to damage your liver, so you don't abuse them.
Right, and OxyContin has no Tylenol
None.
In it. Right.
Exactly, and so it's like a big whack of dope. And once you are able to basically suck off the time-release mechanism coating around the pill, you're left with a big whack of dope.
And so that people, users of this drug, they're able to figure that out pretty quickly, that they
right.
they don't take it as directed, where there's this enteric coating that prevents it from rapidly being absorbed. They start crushing it and snorting it,
right.
or they can even inject it, right, with syringes.
Exactly, and that's how OxyContin becomes abused. It's also, OxyContin is the bridge to heroin. Because once you develop this tolerance to 80 or 150 milligrams or 200 milligrams of oxycodone, which is in OxyContin, a day, after all, you're spending so much money, you've got to switch to heroin. OxyContin provided that bridge that never existed before for addicts to go from Percocet and Vicodin, let's say, abusing those, to OxyContin, and then eventually you have to switch to heroin, usually because of cost, sometimes because simply of availability. Just couldn't find any pills on the street, and so they'd have to switch. But that's how this was important to what we're seeing today.
And so I want to segue into the second really part of your book that's woven throughout. And this is really where I think the book does incredible homework and reporting because you're, you know, all over the U.S. and spending a great deal of time in Mexico. And in some ways, I almost feel like this could be a business book as much as a social history.
It is a business. It's most definitely a business book.
Well, let's talk about that. So you teach us all about the boys from Jalisco. And they come into this market. There's this ready-made market of people addicted to high doses of oxycodone who can, for whatever reason, can't seem to get it prescribed regularly from their physicians or their pill mills are shut down. And suddenly they have this need, this addiction to where they're going to get dope sick if they're going to withdraw from their medicine. And so into this runs this market opportunity. Who were the boys from Jalisco and what made them different?
Their story goes back to the 1980s when immigrants from this little town, the town of Jalisco in the small state of Nayarit on the Mexican coast, in the San Fernando Valley of Los Angeles, began to innovate, take several years, innovate a system of retail sales of black tar heroin. Poppies grow up in the mountains near the town of Jalisco, so they're able to get the goo, the opium goo. They learned how to cook it into black tar heroin. In the United States, in San Fernando Valley, what they learn is how to sell it and how to sell it very effectively. Eventually, they develop a method of selling heroin retail. This is really rare for most Mexican drug groups. Most Mexican drug groups sell wholesale. These guys are selling retail by the tenth of a gram doses, and they're selling it eventually like pizza.
Selling it like
Their
pizza.
Their great innovation is not to bring guns to the story, shootouts for territory and all that nonsense. They are about customer service, convenience, branding, and they will sell to you as if it were pizza. By that I mean an addict calls a phone number, operators standing by to take your order, the operator dispatches the driver to wherever the addict is, near wherever the addict's going to be, a few blocks from the house or maybe whatever part of town he's in, and they make this deal. No guns, the driver's looking very, very kind of low rent. Simple clothes, no bling or anything like that. It's a totally different way of approaching drug trafficking. These guys developed this system through the 80s and into the 90s, and they also begin to expand. It's like a franchise system, basically a heroin franchise system. Think of it that way. Once they saturate the Canoga Park, Van Nuys area of the San Fernando Valley, a few of them begin to move. San Diego, Reno, Portland. They are helped by an abundant pool of labor back home. Guys who see that you can make a lot of money doing this and are raising their hands. These are common farm boys or butchers or bakers, people who have dead-end jobs back home. They're not cartel killers or anything like that. So the system begins to expand. It begins to refine itself in certain rules. They're in towns where there aren't many. There's a kind of a finite number of junkies. And so they begin to, a lot of this customer service thing, well, we'll get it to you in 15 minutes, or we'll give you a free one on Sunday if you buy from us every day during the week, discounts for volume, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So, and this really surprised me, a couple of things. One is it sort of defied the stereotype of kind of the mafioso gun-toting. That's what you, so you talk about how they're really essentially nonviolent and how they really focus on customer service, as you point out, kind of like the pizza delivery. So without having to kind of risk your own life, if you need a hit, You don't have to go out into the dark alley. You literally just call a number, and the dispatcher will send the Jalisco drug dealer to you. What's also interesting is how these guys transported their stuff. So you talk about it, it was a different kind of heroin. It was black tar, I guess. Maybe the plant is different in Central America than it is.
No,
plant,
black
same
tar
opium.
Heroin, black tar heroin is would be white powder heroin if you just process it more.
So it's
black
slightly less processed.
Semi-processed opium goo.
And what are these guys, how do they put the one-tenth of a gram, how do they transport it
that
you mentioned?
They put it into, they roll it into a little ball, put it into a small balloon, and they carry it in their mouth. So these guys, some of them, I met guys who said they could carry 20 to 30 small balloons of heroin in their mouth. The reason they put it in their mouth, these balloons, is because, and they keep a bottle of water next to them in the car at all times. If the cops come, pull them over, they start swigging on that water and swallow all the balloons, and when the cop comes to the window, it's just another Mexican worker of some kind. And so they drive around town basically looking at chipmunks, you know, their mouths packed with these little balloons. But you mentioned that this is not a mafioso thing, and that's very correct. That's why this is so successful, because it allows for common, ordinary guys who are, as I said, are butchers or bakers or sugarcane farmers or what have you, to rise. You don't have to be a member of a cartel. It's a business model. It's not an organization like the Sinaloa cartel, very fearsome and violent organization. You can get into this, and it'll channel those same desires that you, a lot of these guys could have come and worked landscaping or worked drywall hanging or restaurant work. They just happened to be in a town where everybody was selling heroin. The system was very well known. Everyone saw what it could lead to. And a lot of these guys took the chance, but it was because it channeled their energies, those immigrant energies, which is the idea that I'm going to walk through walls to get ahead. I'll do anything to get ahead, to get out of poverty, to get to a place where people respect me and don't humiliate me back home. That kind of thing. That's why this system is so potent. It uses that energy to sell heroin. And, of course, it's heroin being extraordinarily addictive.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. We're talking today with Sam Quinones. He's author of Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. And we're talking about the Jalisco boys. These are young men, usually farm boys, without a lot of job opportunities or job options, who make their way to the United States to essentially work as drug salesmen or runners, putting a tenth of a gram of black tar heroin, minimally processed, into balloons by the dozen, 10 or 20 balloons into their mouths, and answer pages to go out and sell. One of the things that is made clear in your book is these Jalisco boys don't work in the sort of typical places we think of as, you know, we think of William Burroughs and junkies using heroin in New York City or San Francisco. But this is kind of a tale of small town America. I mean, one of the prominent places is Portsmouth, Ohio, where you do sort of almost a demographic social history. And the name of the book, Dreamland, you have multiple themes or motifs with that. But one of them, of course, is the swimming pool, the community pool in Portsmouth, Ohio, that eventually shuts down as sort of the Rust Belt moves in. These Jalisco boys fill this niche in many, you know, smaller towns like, you know, well, Portsmouth, Ohio, or in other places too.
Yes, exactly. They because they're not cartel killers, they are not going to be going up head-to-head with other entrenched drug trafficking gangs like the kind you find in very well-developed heroin markets like, say, Baltimore or New York City or East LA or someplace like that. Because they were really about making money and not about gun battles, they moved to towns where there was no competition. Why would you want to try to spend all that energy breaking into New York City when you've got markets just waiting for you in, say, Salt Lake or Boise or Reno or Indianapolis? Now, the thing that's also important about these guys is, like a franchise, they're very expansion-oriented. Whenever they saturate an area, one guy moves in, let's say, with his cell of like a telephone operator and three drivers. Well, pretty soon another, they could be his cousin, somebody else figures that, moves in as well. And soon there's four or five cells in the same town, let's say Minneapolis or Cincinnati, for example. Well, pretty soon people are going to be looking for better profits elsewhere, and they move out to another part of the country. And to develop that, they are always looking for new markets. And this is what brought them in contact with the pain revolution that I was talking about earlier. They were the first to take black tar heroin across the Mississippi River in sustained large quantities. They were the first Mexican traffickers. Black tar heroin in our hemisphere is only made in Mexico. And for many, many years, it was only on the western side of the United States. These guys were the first guys to bring it east, and they happened very coincidentally to land in the area of Columbus, Ohio, southern Ohio, central and southern Ohio, which at that moment was becoming, in the late 90s, kind of ground zero, both in pain pill promotion and advertisement, and also pain pill addiction.
Tell us about Dr. David Proctor, one of the characters that featured in your book.
He is part of this pain revolution. What you end up having are, you said this is a business story. This is exactly what this is. Opiates are the best drug. If you want to start a business, they're the best drug. Why? Because they create in every client someone who cannot not buy your product. Customer has to buy your product usually several times a day. So these are all the business models are very easy to construct around opiate addicts. And that's what doctors begin to figure out. As more and more doctors are urged to prescribe these drugs, what they end up doing is figuring out some of them, the more scandalous, the more lacking in ethics, begin to almost sell the prescription. So they open up a pain clinic. They, with minimal, if any, diagnosis, they begin prescribing long lists of pills to anybody who wants to pay the fee. And they take only cash, usually $250 a visit, under federal law in order to get prescribed these drugs. Legitimately, you cannot have them filled over the phone or by fax. You have to present yourself personally. And so this means that every month they've got a client who's going to come into their clinic, and they don't take anything but cash, and pay the cash and get this long prescription. David Proctor, that's a business model. It's called a pill mill. I asked the guy, what's the difference between a legitimate pain clinic and a pill mill? He says, well, look at the clientele. If they're in pajamas, if they're standing around in long lines, if they're getting pizza ordered while they're in line, if there's fist fights in line, that's a pill mill. These are people who don't want to get out of line, who want to guard their place in line religiously, and the longer the line, the means more cash for the doctor. That's a pill mill. David Proctor was the godfather of the pill mill. He was the first one to figure it out in Portsmouth, Ohio. And then from there, he trained other doctors in this business. They took jobs with him once he could no longer work in a car accident, could no longer work. He began hiring these doctors. They figure out this business, and then they go out on their own. Other people who are not doctors figure out the business, and they begin hiring doctors on their own and putting them in warehouses or little clinics. And pretty soon, the pill mill model just explodes. This is in the late 1990s again. And so all of this is happening, this pain revolution, the pill mills, all of this is happening in southern Ohio, eastern Kentucky, western West Virginia, parts of Indiana, et cetera, at the very moment when the Jalisco boys from Nayarit, Mexico, crossed the Mississippi with their very, very potent system of marketing heroin retail and selling it light as if you were delivering pizza. They are the first ones. The important part about these guys, too, not only that they have innovated a new way of selling heroin and taken it across about half the United States, it's also that they recognize, or one guy in particular I talk about in the book, recognized that if they simply followed the pills, that the market was going to be expanding geometrically. Remember, most of these guys sold in areas where that had not really, 80s and 1990s, had not really had much expansion in the population of addicts in their area. So you've got, like, Salt Lake, for example, with Portland or whatever. You get some growth in the number of people who are using heroin, but not, it's really small. Pills, they find, and this one guy in particular figures out, will expand the market of addicts geometrically, and that's what begins to happen. They will settle in areas where there's no drug competition, no gangs, none of that, and they are the only ones at the very moment, roughly, when these pills are taking hold and more people are getting addicted. I'm talking first about Columbus, Ohio. That was really like the first place they land just at that moment. And their business model kind of expands to the guys bring it to Nashville, to Charlotte, Indianapolis, Cincinnati, Memphis, et cetera, et cetera, all the Carolinas, basically, over the next few years. Just as these areas were, you know, knee-deep, maybe neck-deep in opiate painkillers, and just as the Purdue Pharma advertising and promotional campaign is in full swing, getting doctors convincing doctors that they're using these pills for all manner of pain is really what they want to want to do. And so this is the importance of the Jalisco Boys. Above and beyond the fact that they innovated this new way of selling heroin, they were the first ones to systematically follow and take advantage of the pill market as it was developing thousands of new addicts. And that's their importance to this epidemic that we see today.
So I want to touch on a couple of things that you highlighted. One is the Jalisco Boys themselves. One of their virtues, besides not carrying guns and being violent to criminals, they were kind of gave the appearance of small timers, just selling these, yeah, you know, small microgram quantities of heroin. They there were just waves and waves of these boys, so that even when local police might catch them, ultimately they wouldn't have enough heroin in their possession where they'd get long jail sentences. And as soon as one might go to jail or might get deported, a new one would come and replace them. And
yes, for these guys, this is the problem that police face in those areas. You can arrest them till you're blue in the face. It's very difficult to eradicate them by that. I mean, get rid of them completely. And that's because back home, as we know, Mexico is filled with young, disgruntled or unhappy young men with a situation where they find themselves. And a lot of them are willing to do a whole bunch to get out of that predicament they find themselves in.
One of the other dreamland motifs you give is for these young Mexican boys to come home, back home to Nayarit with money in their pocket and to go to the annual festival with blue jeans, for example, Levi's 501s, and being able to buy booze for their friends or make an addition or put the new rebar on their house. This is, for them, dreamland, is to be able to come home.
That's their narcotic. They are addicted to that feeling of leading poor. And over the course of a year and a half, say, whatever the time period be, transforming yourself and coming home with enough money to pay for the beer, have all the girls talk to you. One of the most amazing things I learned was that early on, particularly in the 1990s, when I was living in Mexico, I remember this to be true, that Levi's 501s were like the gold standard of Mexican rural menswear. They were very well made, very dark blue. They started out in great contrast to the cheap, flimsy Mexican jeans that people had to wear. And so if you had Levi's 501s, it was like almost a symbol of new wealth or having arrived. Well, these guys, the pioneers of this system from Jalisco, figured out that their system was a perfect vehicle of transforming very cheap, very easy to make hits of black tar heroin into stacks of Levi's 501 jeans. And the way that happened was through the addicts. The addicts were fantastic shoplifters, and they could almost give the addicts orders eventually. I want blue with size this, size that. My nephew needs this. My uncle needs that. And pretty soon, the addicts would come with big, the addicts could clean out a Sears or a Mervyn's or a JCPenney's very easily. And they came with, they would come with these jeans and trade them for dope straight across, one hit for one pair of jeans. And these traffickers would go back to Jalisco like Santa Claus with their trunks packed with Levi's 501s. Other stuff too, tennis shoes, perfume, of course money. But the Levi's 501s seemed to have a particular appeal and potency. And they would hand them out like Santa Claus to all their nephews and their relatives and what have you. When people saw that you could, back home, saw that you could, selling this heroin, you could come home with stacks of Levi's 501s, I mean, all the young boys raised their hands. It was like, sure, I'll do that. That's me. I'd love to do that. I'd love to walk around town, the king, the object of every man's envy. That was the narcotic. These guys weren't addicted to dope. They were addicted to returning home no longer poor. And Levi's 501s were a perfect symbol of that end to poverty that this heroin system allowed for.
Well, so you talk about the barter economy with the Levi's 501 as one example. And I want to pivot back to the American users. And you paint this graphic scene of a couple of towns where OxyContin literally becomes the currency. It's like a proto-Bitcoin or something, where the milligram dosage, like an 80-milligram OxyContin, is like $80 or something. It has that kind of cash value.
That was in the Appalachian, southern Ohio, Rust Belt area, where the pills were just like in Portsmouth area, where you had all these pill mills. You had just fire hoses of pills being blasted at this area. It's just a horrible scene. And eventually, yes, they became like currency pills. You could get, there was OxyContin 40, OxyContin 80, there was generic oxycodone 30s, 20s, 15s, and 10s. And all of these pills, and then of course Vicodin and others as well, they all acted like currency. And for a long time, about a decade there, you could buy almost anything you needed to live with pills instead of currency. In fact, the addicts, if they would rob you, they wouldn't care about your cash. They would look at pills. So you could buy with pills, T-bone steak, cable service, dental appointments, cars, refrigerators, tennis shoes. I mean, really, whatever you needed for life. You could pay the rent. You could do anything with pills, and the pill mills were like the central bank. They monitored the currency, essentially. They were the determinants of monetary policy for the area. But it was one example of how bad this area got, or the pill revolution got. Its wildest, most bizarre, Wild West kind of extreme was in Portsmouth, where for about a decade, pills were currency. And it's just because of the huge, it was just an example, I thought, the huge increase in the quantity of pills all across the country. And this place was just the far extreme.
It was just so bleak. Well, you know, we talked about local law enforcement as being able to kind of chop off the head of the Hydra. They were just kind of getting the arms. But eventually, law enforcement sort of catches on, and they start cooperating across jurisdictions and federal and local authorities. And so they come up with this, I believe, Operation Tar Pit, where they're actually trying to coordinate efforts. And I just was wondering if you could comment on, the book is very current, but where we are today. I mean, are the Jalisco boys still pumping black tar through our economy? Is okay, and it's so.
Yes, the problem that the police face and becomes very clear once you try to deal with this problem is that it's kind of like it's wading into the ocean and trying to keep back the tide. Once, if you have a situation in which new addicts are being created by overuse of pills or overprescribing of pills or just simply using the pills that are sloshing around out there, it is extremely difficult then to fight pill or heroin traffickers, because they will always have demand, and there will always be people wanting to buy. And frankly, the more addicts you create, the more dealers you create. The Jalisco boys are out there, but what's happened in recent years is that more and more of these addicts have become also dealers. The only way you can make your habit every day is by selling pills frequently, or heroin. And so you've got a huge geometric increase in the number of dealers out there as well. And so this makes it very, very difficult for the police to really do anything truly effective, because as long as you have this enormous, fierce demand for this, and it's growing, and it's all across the country, it's very difficult for police officers to do much of anything, I think.
Well, so the success of the Jalisco Boys model, you know, using these small quantities and this black tar at very low prices and this service-based type of promotion, I mean, it seems like others have caught on, and some of the older drug cartels do now seem to want to encroach on their territory. You give us that impression.
But I don't believe this. Yes, but I don't believe they're selling it the way these guys do. Most of the cartels, they're not interested in selling $10 balloons worth of heroin. They're talking about kilos. You're talking about multi-kilo levels of drugs. That's what makes these guys different. They are the only drug cartel from Mexico, or drug, I wouldn't call them a cartel. They're kind of a network. Let's call them the drug network or confederation of traffickers who go from the poppy, cooking the goo into black tar heroin, transporting it across the border, and then retailing it. Others get all the way across but don't retail it. I mean, there's a lot of variations, but the only group that I've ever heard of that does all of that are the Jalisco Boys from Jalisco, Nayarit. That's it. They're out of Mexico anyway. And that helps them because they don't cut their dope. They don't dilute it. Frequently they don't dilute it. And some do, but most of them do not.
Yeah, that's
and
another...
that means that they can brand their balloon. They can brand their dope. Every balloon you buy, you know it's going to include a tenth of a gram, and it's going to be really potent. Because it's our dope. We're not selling the way heroin gets sold. It goes sold from one person to the next. That person dilutes it, sells it double the quantity to somebody else. That person takes it and dilutes it again, and so double the quantity. A fourth person, by the time it hits the street, heroin is 12 to 15% potent. These guys are routinely sell heroin at 60 to 80% pure because they don't cut it. They control their own supply. That's a very rare mixture, particularly with heroin.
And so for people who don't have a high tolerance for opiates, getting that kind of purity is going to lead to overdoses frequently.
It has. And normally these guys are also very careful about that, though, because they don't want people to die. They don't want people dying of their dope. They want them to be customers forever, of course. Why would you want the person to die? So they also do take care of that. But the truth is, It has created problems, overdoses, people getting a hold of dope. It's way too potent for them. And it's frequently because people are used to the dope sold on the street, and then the dope that these guys would sell, which is quite a bit more potent.
The name of the book is Dreamland. It's the true tale of America's opiate epidemic. And the author is our guest today, Sam Quinones. You've done a wonderful job reporting this book. Congratulations.
Thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Sam Quinones is a former reporter for the Los Angeles Times. His book is called Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, published by Bloomsbury. For questions or comments about the show, email us at john@glasshospital.com. That's our show for this week. Medical Matters is produced at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa on the campus of the University of Tulsa. The show is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. Original music is composed by Scott Griffith. You can find more of his music at scottygriffith.com. Join us next week for a discussion with Damon Tweedy, author of the new book, Black Man, White Coat, about what it means to be a black doctor in the United States today. Until then, I'm John Schumann. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.